Okay, I'll say a few words about the motivation. Basically, there's some practical considerations or possible technologies that might grow out of these molecular magnets, and there's also some really neat experiments that have been done. And then I'll talk about our attempts to calculate the barriers, the magnetic reorientation temperatures within density functional theory using LS coupling. And by kind of going through examples, I want to simultaneously try to discuss what determines the principal magnetic axes and the barriers. The things you have are pairing dependencies, global versus local Anisotropy Hamiltonians, how the total moment influences the magnetic reorientation temperature, and whether or not you can change the magnetism by changing ligands. And at the same time, I want to talk about why it seems to work. First question would be, well, density functional, these things depend on densities. So in principle, a density functional theory should yield magnetic reorientation barriers. But I also want to try to discuss it from the context of a many-electron Hamiltonian using the density functional Hamiltonian as the first reference state. And if time permits, I'll say a little bit about fourth-order magnetic anisotropies. So there's been, well, right now there's probably about 10 or 12 molecular magnets that are being studied experimentally, and the most popular prototype is manganese 12. However, they all kind of look the same if you stand far enough away from them. What you have are a collection of six-fold coordinated magnetic centers, and these are transition metals, they're spin-ordered in general, so you don't have ferromagnetism or exact anti-ferromagnetism. They tend to have rather large net moments. This one has a net moment of 10. And the spin ordering is locked by super exchange, usually through oxygen atoms. And these super exchange interactions are very large energies compared to the magnetic reorientation temperature. So this is kind of the fundamental object, but what makes the experiments possible is that you can freeze them or make a crystal of them. And neighboring molecules are actually very far apart. They're somehow frozen in place by hydrogen bonding. A lot of these molecular magnets have quite a bit of water of crystallization in them. And so what you achieve is this large lattice of single spin molecular magnets, where you can do an experiment on Avogadro's number worth of these molecular magnets at a time. And that way they can get good signals. And this is the iron-8 molecular magnet. And this is the experimental X-ray data. This is from calculation. OK, the motivation for this is that it's interesting from the standpoint of designing magnetic storage to be able to predict magnetic reorientation temperatures. And there's a nice article, now pretty old, from Service in Science, March 2000, which discusses the current storage bit being hundreds of 15 to 20 nanometer grains, and attempts at replacing these by molecular magnets or iron cobalt, iron platinum clusters, which would give you a very large increase in magnetic storage density.
Is there a future in these mechanical magnetic storage systems?
Remains to be seen. I'm not an expert on that part of the problem. The neat physics is due to originally Friedman et al. And Thomas et al. Simultaneously, saw resonant tunneling of magnetization. And again, the first molecule where this was observed was manganese 12 oxygen 12 acetate, which I'll talk at length about. And then There's a second type of tunneling that is actually a little bit more interesting, and from the standpoint of physics anyways, transverse tunneling, first predicted by Garg, and iron 8 oxygen 2, the molecule that I just showed you, is a case where you get this transverse tunneling. And I'll explain it a little bit more, but it's really different physics than spin-dependent transport or tunneling, because at the end of the event, the charge density hasn't changed at all, only the spin orientation. So this is a cartoon on the longitudinal tunneling. You have a single spin object, and it's a uniaxial magnet, so the energy as a function of the M quantum number is just either a right side up or upside down parabola. And you place it in the magnetic field. So this is the energy as a function of M state. And this is completely akin to what you have in atomic physics when M states cross. If you pick the magnetic field such that it's some integer times this constant, you line up M states on one side of the barrier with M states on the other side of the barrier. So the gist of the steps in the hysteresis is that as they're sweeping the magnetic field, they achieve situations where they have resonance between states on one side of the barrier and the other side of the barrier. So anything that depends on a rate constant changes discontinuously. When you have poor alignment, you have to kind of do classical jumping over the barrier, and so you have one rate constant. And when you simultaneously align states on one side of the barrier with states on the other side of the barrier, then you open up other ways of achieving spin reorientation by these shortcuts, and they see these discontinuities in the hysteresis loop, and that tells you what this anisotropy parameter is. Okay, so that's kind of the more traditional tunneling event that you would have deduced from atomic physics. There's also transverse tunneling, which was first predicted by Anupen Garg in 1993 and almost definitely observed by Wernsdorfer and Cecily about 3 or 4 years ago in iron 8. And in this case, you don't have a uniaxial molecular magnet. You have something that's almost uniaxial. And then you have this extra transverse term, which basically means the barrier to go jump that way is one energy, and the barrier to go through the x-axis is a different energy, classically. And what Garg has shown is that when you apply a magnetic field along the hard axis, you start at zero field with almost a collection of S two-fold degeneracies and one one-fold degeneracy, almost. And then as you apply this magnetic field along the hard axis, the sets of quasi two-fold degeneracies split ever so slightly. And then as you change the magnetic field, they attract one another. And they keep doing it over and over again. So they split, attract, split, attract, split, attract. And so again, when they've attracted one another, if you're measuring some sort of tunneling rate, that's going to be higher than when they're repelling one another. And so this is a numerical calculation I did to just test his analytic formula. And basically what you see is that at integer values of the square root of 2e times e plus d, you get these degeneracies, attracted degeneracies. The splitting energy is always very, very small, but that's the other experiment one can do to measure something that relates the transverse anisotropy parameter. Okay, so what we want to do is calculate anisotropy Hamiltonians within DFT, and along the way I'm going to try to say how the story would be different with DFT plus Hubbard U or DFT plus SIC, and would certainly be happy to know what I might be able to improve with dynamical mean field theory. So I don't think I have to say anything about density functional theory. The energy depends on the density. We solve Schrodinger's equation, so we happen to use Gaussians. And we move the atoms around until the Hellman-Feynman forces are zero. So this is the vanadium-15 molecular magnet. And essentially what we do is expand a single particle wave function in terms of these Gaussian orbitals times some polynomial. And then we find these constants. And the thing that's of import to magnetism is these spinners. And in particular, these spinners are only defined up to two angles. You could define up and down, up this way and down that way, or up that way and down that way. And it's the change in energy as a function of how you define the axis of quantization that defines the magnetic reorientation barrier. And this is going to be true regardless of whether I'm doing density functional theory or many electron wave function. This is just an advertisement for NRO Mall, which we sort of distribute to the public. This is our website, and we do everything numerically. Okay, so this is the manganese-12 acetate molecule. It has, they call this the cubane core, so you start by making something the smallest possible manganese oxide crystal fragment. And then you try to extend the crystal fragment by adding another manganese 2 oxygen 2 fate, rhombus here and here. And then you rotate it by 90 degrees and reflect it to get another couple of these faces. And then you tie them together by another manganese. So you have 8 yellow manganese, kind of these are the crown manganese, and 4 cubane manganese. These are the in purple. And then if you tried to do an experiment on just that part, it would fall apart very quickly. So you have to bring in ligands. And the ligands that are used in the experiment are acetate ligands, which are these CO2 ligands that are tied off by methyl radicals. And then you have some water molecules that are sitting above some of these crown manganese to make them think they're six-fold coordinated. And then in addition, in the unit cell, there's some acetate molecules and some other water molecules that just fill up space. The need for the methyl radicals here is to separate the magnetic centers, so you really achieve this situation where the magnetic centers are not interacting. So we've replaced them by hydrogens. And you can do a calculation, and what I show here is the all electron projected density of states. So the majority is yellow, and I've projected the total density states onto both the inner manganese and the outer manganese. So you can see that indeed you get a significant amount of majority spin on the outer manganese. There's some oxygen 2p in the same energy range. And the opposite holds for the inner manganese, that you have minority manganese on the inside. And so it's very magnetic. It's kind of approaching a half-metallic ferrimagnet. The majority-majority gap is 0.43 volts, and the minority gap is 2.03 volts. So if you want to kind of go look at excitations from this reference state, you need a Wannier description of the magnetic core. And so I guess, first of all, the outer ligands, acetate or formate, carry one extra electron. They're very happy closed shell systems, so you don't have to consider the formates at all in kind of trying to explain the electronic structure. And the water molecules also are closed shell systems. So the O2 minus anions, these red guys that bridge between different manganese, have a full shell of p states, and you can kind of see from the density of states plot that but they tend to be at lower energies than the manganese D. And then you have three types of manganese, but for the most part, the outer crown have the same electronic structure, and the inner cubane has a different electronic structure. So the outer crown, you can kind of do this in a variety of ways, calculate the charge within a sphere around these, and what you find is that there's basically four d electrons on the outer crown, and on the inner cubane there's three d electrons. So the reason we have a large gap from minority to minority is that the EG 1A functions are unoccupied on the inner core, and the EG are split on the outer core, and there's kind of a local Yontelar distortion about these yellow manganese. So this is about 4/10 of a volt. This is about 2 volts. Robinson, who's now in Australia, but when he did this work was at Los Alamos, has done neutron scattering and inelastic neutron scattering and determined that there is a difference of about 1 d electron between the two sites. And you can also kind of predict that from electron counting using conventional chemistry arguments. So what you end up with is 8 spin 2 manganese, 8 times 2 is 16, and 4 spin 3 halves manganese in the opposite direction. So that's 16 minus 6, and that spin of 10.
The EG state, you draw it as schematical, or it should be degenerate, right? I mean,
it starts out degenerate, but if you compare the kind of the local structure of the outer manganese to the inside, on the outer ones you have an elongated axis.
So there's a Yontelar distortion.
Yeah, and they split apart. But it's exactly a Yontelar splitting of those two states. So I want to get back to this when I try to justify.
Those were the energy levels of the guys at the boundary, not in the center.
These are the boundary and these are the center.
Uh-huh.
So you there's no Yontelar, no local Yontelar distortion here. You can kind of just look at bond lengths, for example.
And so the one in the center, I should think of it as really degenerate. I mean, you just split it just to show it's doubly degenerate, but they're
right.
The same energy.
Yeah, okay. So this is the these are degenerate.
Okay.
It's like some kind of orbital order.
Yeah. There's an experimental gap. Musfeld et al. Have measured it. We get 4/10 of a volt, and what I remember is their gap is about the right amount larger for kind of a standard reduction in gap. Maybe a little bit too large. It's consistent, their experimental gap. Okay, so I want to talk about the anisotropy, and this was explained by Van Vleck in 37. This is the chromine amide molecular magnet, but essentially it only has one center, and you have electrons moving an electric field. The electric field is due to all the nuclei and all the electrons, and as a result, they think they see a magnetic field, and the spin up are sad, and the spin down are happy, and on average the energy hasn't changed at all, the lowest order, and it's second order is the first order where the energy depends on whether this is up or that's up. From the standpoint of our wave functions, they're carrying around a spinner. And if I choose some canonical up and down states, then I can make a continuous set of spinners that depend on two angles, theta and beta. The phase, there's an arbitrary phase that I've thrown out. And you calculate the energy as a function of these two angles. And you can back out a Hamiltonian that essentially looks like a gamma tensor times SASB. Once you have this Hamiltonian, you diagonalize it, and get to the form that the experimentalists measure.
That's the total S of the sum of all the 12 manganeses or whatever?
Yes.
Or you're saying this is the iron, so this is the iron
so,
molecule that has this hand.
This is universal, but so these are spin 1/2 particles, but you're asking the question, what if every spin 1/2 electron simultaneously does the same somersault? And you can find the energy associated with that. Kind of think of it in terms of a classical spin.
I mean, this is for each Kohn-Sham orbital, basically.
Each Kohn-Sham orbital has a spinner, either a spin 1 spinner or a spin 2 spinner on it.
You use a theta and beta the same for all?
Yeah, so every spinner on every Kohn-Sham orbital is performing the same somersault. And so you get an energy associated with that, and traditionally in the derivation what's done is to divide and multiply by the total moment. The derivation is actually simpler if you compare how the energy changes to the expectation value of SB.
There's nothing to stop you from finding a more detailed Hamiltonian in terms of the spins on each of the individual.
Right, and I'll get to that in a little bit.
Other terms like anisotropic exchanges in general.
Right.
I mean, the fact that this,
And I'll make an argument at the end why that's a very small correction. So. Okay, so we're looking at small energies, and the thing to remember is that the density functional energy is completely invariant to these somersaults that all the electrons are doing, but the spin orbit energy is not. So when you do things in terms of second order perturbation theory, you end up having to calculate these matrix elements that are as large as any other matrix element you calculate in density functional theory, and then at the very end of the calculation, you divide by the speed of light to the fourth power, which makes it a small number. So what we need to do is first convince ourselves that we can calculate these matrix elements within density functional theory. And I just have a couple examples for comparing a noble gas to the Dirac equation and comparing calculated manganese 2p splittings to experiment by Ederer et al. And some ruthenium 2p splittings to experiments by a group in Wisconsin. And basically you can see that both this calculation has a little bit of exchange splitting mixed in. It's hard to separate them. But basically you get about, say, 3% to 4% accuracy in the spin orbit matrix elements. Very briefly, we're using this version of the spin orbit interaction. Textbook makes the further approximation to put it in terms of a radioelectric field, but it turns out that if you use this version, it's exceedingly simple to implement into any generalized gradient approximation code. And the reason being is that you can, this is a Cartesian representation, so when you get your matrix elements, you can integrate by parts, take the gradient off of the Coulomb potential and put it on the basis functions. And everybody calculates gradients and basis functions. And at the end of the day, what you end up with is the Coulomb potential with derivatives of your basis elements on either side. And it's exact and very easy to implement. So the first test we did, this was on MN12, which is the canonical prototype now. We've got a second order barrier of 55.7 Kelvin, and Barra et al. Had 55.6 at that time. We've recalculated this barrier for different spin orderings, which impact the anisotropic exchange contributions, for different vibrational displacements, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 or 600 different excitations, if you will, out of this ground state. And this number changes by about 2 Kelvin, depending on phonon displacement, spin ordering, et cetera. So it's a very stable number. And so the questions you always get from chemists are, what about correlations? What about spin contamination? And one answer is that in density functional theory, you're not supposed to use the Kohn-Sham orbitals to construct a Slater determinant, and so therefore you really don't have spin contamination. But as we've seen, a lot of people are starting to use density functional based cone-sham orbitals to construct Slater determinants for example, Monte Carlo simulations with Jastrow factors and whatnot. And so it'd be nice to be able to kind of accept some physicality of the constructed cone-sham determinant and then be able to argue that even with many, many configurations, you're still going to get the same anisotropy as you do with in-density functional theory. And so what we're trying to do is put up some straw men as at least a way of possibly analyzing cases when it doesn't work. So this is a Slater determinant. Again, you have a space, a bunch of single electron orbitals that absolutely have to be orthonormal to do the math. Product of a spatial part and a spin part, and the spin part is going to depend on those two angles. And what I'm going to do is use the cone-sham orbital as cone-sham orbitals to construct the ground state, and then assume that we're going to look at add on a whole bunch of other configurations that are correspond to excited states. So so this is standard configuration interaction. And for this, you need to use the many electron version of the spin orbit operator, which is found in Slater, for example. And then you can start with this multi-configurational wave function and calculate the spin orbit energy. And you get diagonal terms and off-diagonal terms. And one of these diagonal terms would correspond to the cone-sham Slater determinant, and the rest would correspond to excitations out of it. So then the question is how can this give you the same anisotropy barrier, this multi-configurational dependence on the spin orbit energy as density functional theory does? And so so what I'm going to try to argue is that, okay, so first let's hope that we can argue all of these terms away. Then, the way these terms can add up to the cone-sham is if all of the diagonal terms are the same. And if they're not the same, that it corresponds to such a high excitation that these coefficients are very, very small. Okay? Okay, so that's how we can get all of these terms to reproduce the density functional anisotropy Hamiltonian. And then the question is how can these terms all vanish? Well, if for the terms that have large constants, these off-diagonal many electron states have to go to zero. And for the terms that these are zero, we don't have to worry about it. So that's what I want to try to argue is, for the case of manganese 12, that these conditions hold. That that for all excitations which are small enough for sinu to be appreciable, you get the same anisotropy. And for higher excitations, either these are zero because, or there's no off-diagonal element between well-populated configurations. And so go back to the 1A description, and the sorts of excitations you can have are these EG to EG excitations. You could have minority D to either one of these. Those are large numbers. And you could presumably have spin charge transfer interactions where you change this from a spin 2 to a spin 3 halves and that to a spin 2. Okay, so the majority excitations are going to be the smallest single electron excitations available. And those we calculate to be 4/10 of a volt is the smallest. A localized spin flip, where you actually flip one 1A function on a site, is going to have a very large energy, probably significantly greater than a volt. But it's somehow related to the exchange splitting. And the charge transfer, we haven't been able to stabilize a charge transfer determinant, but because they're not stable. but you can kind of at least estimate that it should be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 over the distance between these two sites, so somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 volts. And then you can have concerted local moment flips, three or four d electrons at once. So I can change this purple manganese into a yellow one, and at the same time it can change its neighboring yellow ones into purple ones. And these are very small energies, on the order of 0.05 volts, and I think Sasha's group has shown that, you know, density functional theory kind of overestimates these excitations, and that if you put in a Hubbard U, they get even smaller. So these are the ones you have to concentrate and somehow argue that after you create that excitation, the anisotropy remains the same, and there's no off-diagonal element. And so, so first of all, the off-diagonal elements. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change this one into a yellow manganese, and that one into a purple manganese. Except I used purple and red instead here. So purple goes to red. The two large red ones go to a large purple one and a large red one. And another. So I've changed the expectation value of SZ from 10 to 9. Another way of changing the expectation value of SZ from 10 to 9 is to do the same sort of excitation here, where purple goes to red and red goes to purple. This one stays the same. And so if you do that, you have to think about what happens to the Slater determinant. And you only have to think about what happens related to the on-site terms. So simply by flipping this these 3D electrons into 3D electrons of opposite spin, in the Slater determinant, I change three alphas to betas, and these are orthogonal spinners. And since the spin-orbit interaction is a sum of two particle interactions, there's no matrix element between Slater determinants that differ by more than two orthogonal states. So this already has, once you've accomplished the first spin flip, you've already ruled out any sort of off-diagonal component to the anisotropy energy. And then you flip four more, and now you have a Slater determinant that differs by 7 orbitals. So there's no direct off-diagonal spin orbit matrix elements. So that gets rid of all the off-diagonal terms where the energies are small. And what we've been doing is going through all the possible excitations that one can do. Sasha's group has also done these calculations. I think they're the energies are about the same scale. And so there's two SZ equal 9 states, there's an S equal 8, et cetera, S equal 13. This is the energy, the DFT energy of those states relative to the DFT ground state. And this is the calculated magnetic anisotropy of the state. And so what you can see is it's changing by, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of a Kelvin as a function of spin ordering. And what we want to do next is try to use this data to construct an anisotropic spin Hamiltonian and try to get some of the coupling between spin excitations and global reorientations into the calculation. Okay, so that's probably about as much as one can do in terms of trying to justify density functional theory without doing a configuration interaction calculation. So I just want to go through a few more examples and that are being looked at experimentally, and try to discuss kind of the phenomenology of what makes a big anisotropy and what makes a small anisotropy. So manganese 12 is the one I just got done talking about, and manganese 10 is a spin 12 or 13 molecular magnet that people have been working on. And you might expect that, especially since you have spin operators in the anisotropy Hamiltonian, that this should have a larger anisotropy that somehow should scale as S squared. So this is S squared 144 versus 100. But that's not what's found experimentally. This is a 60 Kelvin reorientation barrier, and this is a 8 Kelvin reorientation barrier. And what we found when we did this calculation were a couple effects. The first effect was that the local moments of these manganese are S equals 5 halves, so you have a closed D shell. And if you think in terms of that kind of being a spherical manganese versus these being non, at least some of these being non-spherical, you'd expect this to have a slightly smaller anisotropy. That argument doesn't really completely work when you actually do the calculation, because they're not really spherical environments. But what we did find is that in manganese 12, there's four interactions. There's coupling between occupied up and unoccupied down, occupied down and unoccupied up, et cetera. There's four pairing interactions. And in manganese 12, we got constructive interference of all the pairing interactions, whereas in manganese 10, we got destructive. And as a result, even though the four separate terms were on the same magnitude as the four separate terms in manganese 12, in one case you get large, and in the other case you get small anisotropies. And so the experiment, the comparison is 9 Kelvin for density functional theory and 8 Kelvin for experiment for this biphenoxide version of a molecular magnet. And this is just to show that the density states are also the same qualitatively. They have kind of a reasonably small D to D gap, but certainly a healthy gap compared to a spin orbit splitting of a valence state. Mueller et al. At Erlangen kind of challenged Jens Cortes, a former postdoc, to predict something before it was measured. And so he did, and he got a D per, this is, these are S equal 5 iron atoms, they form a star. So he got, and it's not uniaxial, so he got a D parameter of 0.56 Kelvin and an E parameter of 0.064 Kelvin, and the experimentalists measured it after words. Well, actually, they measured it before and after, their first set of measurements were in pretty good agreement with ours, and their second set were slightly better. But again, these are large numbers that we're calculating, and the matrix elements are large. Okay. This is a cobalt-4 molecular magnet, and this was built by Hendrickson down in San Diego and Christou. It's the first completely ferromagnetic molecular magnet, and you have four cobalts. Cobalts are surrounded by oxygens, three oxygens, a chlorine, four oxygens, and then a nitrogen. So these are pyridine rings. And this is one of our problem cases. The first experimental result was 200 Kelvin, and it actually turns out that you can take the same experimental data and use two different models to try to back out the experimental anisotropy, and there's a factor of 2 in there. So experiment has 100 to 200 on this anisotropy. And when we did the calculation, we kind of started with the experimental geometry, which kind of had the pyridines like this, and then as we optimized the geometry, the pyridines repelled one another, which seems very physical, at least for isolated molecule. And our anisotropy decreased from 60 Kelvin to 23 Kelvin. So we're unsure at this point whether the disagreement is really because in the crystal packing effects could really change this paradigm phase separation.
You say even if you force the system to the geometry in the crystal, you are not where the experiment is.
Right. And
the 60, right?
Right. And we can't, that's the 60. And with the caveat that, you know, the hydrogens are never really very well determined from the experimental data. And so it was an approximate, it was the best possible model we could construct from the experimental X-ray data. And I think that, 100 Kelvin for 4 cobalts would be a very, very large number. And I think that we're probably in the right ballpark there.
Why does the hydrogen reduce the moment so much?
Oh, well, that was, again, because of the fact they're doing, because of the fact they're doing X-ray determination of the data, the hydrogen positions are always a little bit hard to pin down. And this pyridine radical generally carries around another hydrogen that would be attached to this, to this carbon. So if it were a gas phase pyridine, it has one extra hydrogen on it. And then the question is whether that hydrogen remains or falls off. And we found that it was energetically favorable for the hydrogen to fall off and off of these 4 pyridines. So we think that the hydrogen's not on there. If we don't put the hydrogen on there, we get the right experimental moment and the right, and if we add them, we reduce it by 4 spin
lines. I guess the question being asked is if the cobalt electronic structure is not that different, and if it has the same moment on each of the cobalts, and if they're still ferromagnetically aligned, mm-hmm. why should it make any difference whether or not there is hydrogen?
Well, because you're going to add, the lowest electronic states are cobalt minority, and so if you add 4 hydrogens,
so you change the ionization.
You're essentially adding 4 electrons to the system, and so you're going to start kind of filling in these and reducing the moment by 4.
Hydrogen bind to the carbon, right?
Yeah.
Bind directly to
CO. Yeah. I mean, probably the fact that we just didn't get a covalent bond at the hydrogen, so. So from the X-ray data, it wasn't clear whether the hydrogen was supposed to be there or not. It's not there. So okay. So now what we're trying to do is determine why some cases are why a system is chooses a certain axis. And if you look at the expression for the Anisotropy Hamiltonian. It's derived from second order perturbation theory. So you kind of get a bunch of terms that have pairs of occupied and unoccupied states in a numerator, and you can imagine that those are then can be decomposed into diagonal center contributions and off diagonal contributions. And to the extent that the d states are localized, you can ask what the Anisotropy Hamiltonian is just due to the part on each cobalt. And what we've found when we do that decomposition is that, first of all, if you sum up 4 local Anisotropy Hamiltonians, you basically reproduce the total Anisotropy Hamiltonian to high accuracy. These states really are localized. And the way cobalt 4, which kind of disagrees with experiment, differs from manganese 12, which agrees with experiment, is that in manganese 12, when you do this alignment, you have the global Anisotropy axis this way, and if you look at any manganese atom, you have the easy axis on that manganese almost parallel to what is the final global uni axis. In this case, what happens is that you have a medium axis aligned with the global. The local medium axes are determining the global easy axis, and what you have are hard axes in the top plane in the y direction, and in the bottom plane in the x direction. So what the system decides to do is stay out of the plane determined by x and y, because then some of these electrons are going to be pointing along local hard axes. And so this is called the orthogonal alignment of local hard axes. And the experimentalists actually suggested this model, and our calculations seem to agree with it. So, but having said that, so now in this case, we have the local easy axis is approximately orthogonal to the global easy axis. And this would probably be a case where non-collinear magnetism might make a real difference. I'm not sure.
But in your density functional theory, your spin is totally unrestricted, right? You can point in any direction.
The axis, in our calculations, the axis of quantization can point in any direction.
Right.
But but it doesn't change, the axis of quantization at this point anyways, doesn't change as a function of where you are in the atom.
Oh,
and that's the non-collinearity. And that would possibly allow this cobalt 4 to kind of pick two different easy axes to align, and there'd at least be a propensity towards it. And whether or not it would be large enough is another question. So we're trying to look at that by, you know, calculating J's and kind of setting up model Hamiltonians, which allow. Finally, I just wanted to get back to iron 8 because every time I give a talk, I give a different answer. And we're back to the first answer we got. For those of you that were at the magnetism conference this summer, we're not reproducing experiment here. And it turned out we were calculating exactly half the anisotropy by accident. This is kind of the ones where we've currently looked at, and I think that there's at least enough cases where agreement is basically within a few percent that that I think it's time to really start trying to figure out whether possibly one can not argue away certain terms that were possible to argue away in manganese 12 for iron 8 and cobalt 4. Okay. And then just very briefly, I want to tell you one last thing we've been working on, and that's so the difference between these molecular magnets and a lot of useful bulk magnets is that they're low symmetry. And so what that means is that the reorientation barrier to lowest order goes as 1 over the speed of light to the fourth power. And whereas in bulk nickel, it goes as 1 over the speed of light to the eighth power. And it's much, much more difficult to calculate fourth order anisotropies because, at least in my opinion, there's only one effect that impacts directly second order anisotropies. And I think there's 5 or 6 that impact directly fourth order anisotropies. For these molecular magnets, there are measurements on the fourth order effects. And in fact, for manganese 12, the total barrier is 65 Kelvin. Because of the resonances, they can really pull out the D to be to the second order effect to give you 57 of those Kelvin. But then there's another 8 Kelvin in the barrier that's due to higher order anisotropies. This fourth order contribution to the anisotropy Hamiltonian and molecular magnets basically determines the splittings of the M states, the very small splittings, and those very small splittings determine the rates at which you get resonant tunneling of magnetization. Currently, nobody agrees on why the splittings are so large, particularly for odd M splittings. The spin Hamiltonian that has the same symmetry as the molecule will not strongly couple odd M states, although it strongly couples M equal 2 and M equals minus 2. So this is the form of the allowed fourth order term. And what we've been trying to do is determine which effects can impact fourth order anisotropies. And I think that, well, anisotropic exchange Hamiltonian is one of the things that should be considered. We've calculated a spin-vibron calculation. So if we do second-order perturbation theory, we get a second-order anisotropy Hamiltonian, which gives us 57 Kelvin, say. If we do exact diagonalization, we pick up that 57 Kelvin plus a decrease by 1 Kelvin in the anisotropy barrier due to exact diagonalization. Experiment says that should be 5 to 10 Kelvin. And so we have the, so we've, what do I do now? So what we've done is started looking at the analog of magnetoelastic contributions to anisotropy. And we call it the spin-vibron interaction. But essentially what you do is you couple an anisotropic Hamiltonian to a spin, to a harmonic oscillator, and it's an exactly solvable problem. And you find that the energy of the harmonic oscillator is omega over 2 plus the energy of the anisotropic spin. And then this other term, which depends on derivatives of the gamma matrix as a function of phonon frequency. And so it's once you calculate these coupling constants by doing frozen phonon calculations, you can evaluate the fourth order anisotropy. We've done this, and we've taken a lot of major shortcuts in terms of under convergence, using very small basis sets and pseudopotentials on all the non-magnetic atoms, which I don't think should make any difference at all.
Pardon me, do you consider in this calculation the Zielinski-Moria anti-symmetric kind of exchange interaction?
I've asked that question myself. And
they're lower order in this neural coupling.
So, what I can tell you is everything we include is what you get out of the diagonal contributions of the many electron spin orbit operator. And Thomas Schultes tells me that includes the DM interaction. I'd appreciate knowing your.
Okay, so I mean, what you wrote on that transparency wasn't the full possibility of the algebraic form that you could recalculate like a general matrix, if there was any DM interaction.
What I have included is all diagonal effects that come from the many electron spin orbit operator, and. We'll have to talk, because I can't give you a positive answer. I think time's short, so I'll just call it quits at this point and tell you that, at least for our first pass through, we're getting an enhancement of the barrier in manganese 12 of about 10%. We've redone cobalt 4 to full accuracy, and we got a 3% enhancement due to magnetoelasticity. Or spin vibron, and take questions if there are any.
Yeah, I have a question. Can we go back to the ones where you had the good examples where the density functional theory works perfectly and then you have a couple of failures?
Yeah.
And can you comment on what you think is important about the molecules where the DFT doesn't do so well? I mean, is it because the gap can correlate perhaps with what's the experimental gap and the theoretically predicted gap? And perhaps one can say that in the systems where the gap comes out wrong, then anisotropy also comes out wrong. Or is there some systematics or way to rationalize this?
I don't think that Okay, for iron 8, we get an exceedingly small gap within density functional theory, practically metallic. And so certainly small gap versus large gap is going to in some way increase the theoretical anisotropy Hamiltonian. So that's a possibility in iron 8. We've now gone through iron 8 and looked at different charge states of iron by adding and not using all the bromines, or in some cases using all the bromines. That doesn't seem to make a difference. And we haven't been able to do this local decomposition of the anisotropy Hamilton, of the local anisotropies in iron 8. So my best guess is that the reason it's not working here is different than the reason we're not in disagreement with experiment here. And I really expect to see this experimental number come down.
Because in cobalt 4, you get the gap more or less right. That's the point?
Well, no, we certainly don't. We get it right within density functional theory. But I mean, so you could argue that that's too small of a gap, and therefore you should overestimate. But you can make the same argument in electronic polarizabilities. And in that case, you get the empirical result is that you get polarizabilities correctly even without the correct gap.
Yeah.
This system has some funny anomalies that, you know, there's the two experiments you can do to measure the D and the square root of 2D plus E. And basically, the two experiments don't agree with one another. So there's some room for disagreement with experiment here. But this is probably just fourth order effects, maybe.
To identify what is DFT and what are the other problems, I also want to add this transparency. And I mean, when we do very different systems, but also cobalt, iron, manganese, and there are several other aspects when one does the calculation. So I have some questions. The first question is, are you using a pseudopotentials or are you using an all-electron?
The only time we used the pseudopotential was for the spin orbit fibron stuff. And that was on the organic.
So you have also core polarization. Because in these systems, you sometimes have very interesting magnetization. Like you have spin density or valence electron pointing one direction and the more core shell to the other direction. So it's really a very...
Yeah, we have that.
It's a very interesting phenomenon, but it has to be included.
Right,
the same
that would
question
be in
which troubles us a lot is really what UGA one should really use, and connected to that is, well, I think all the 3Ds, apparently relativistic effect and GGAs, which are all argentium based, don't go well together.
Yes.
And relativistic effect play quite a role in these 3D transition metals.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that included and tested?
Okay, so...
So just in a semi-relativistic way would be sufficient, but it has a big effect.
Right. So if you use a semi-relativistic, we're not. These are non-relativistic, and so if you were to put in scalar relativity, and so suppose you do everything self-consistently with scalar relativity, then the shapes of the d radial functions are going to change slightly. I think they're going. Let's see. They're going to get a little bit larger, right?
Everything gets worse if you do it better.
Everything? You mean like bond lengths and whatnot?
Yes,
or okay. So they increase.
Well, quite noticeable, actually. I think nearly 1% if you put relativistic effects. So I mean, there's some other trouble we have, right? So
yeah.
The question is if you blame it on the DFT or if you just blame it on the fact that we don't understand some aspects.
Right. I mean, there's... Okay, So the direct effect is the equation for the d parameter is going to be exactly the same to one over order 1/2c², except the shape of each radial function is each radial function is going to change as 1/2c².
Also, the moment changes a lot when you go from LDA to GGA. The GGA tries to promote the magnetism somehow.
Yeah, no, I haven't I agree with that. We haven't done much with anything but the PBE-GGA, and I expect that PBE and PW91 should be about the same. And for oxygen too, I've compared LDA and GGA and gotten the same answer. I guess. Well, there's so many different things you have, knobs you have to turn these days.
It's probably worrying in the 3D series, you include semi-relativistic effects that get worse.
Yeah, I would be worrying. I'm not sure it will, do you think it definitely will get worse? If you change the radial function by 10%, that's...
Some things you talk is not so big effects at the end.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know either. We're slowly but surely getting in scalar relativity.
Yeah, we fight with our symbols and more, so
okay. Well, thank you.
One announcement. So before everybody is in general, tomorrow we have a discussion, very important discussion session at 10. Everybody will participate and actively will get a free pizza.
Free pizza?
Free pizza. There's no free pizza. You need to participate. And so let's thank Mark. Okay.